Hi, ladies, and welcome to the Story Night podcast. I'm Jessica Campbell, and stories are my passion. It's my honor to host this podcast where real women share real stories of real hope. Each episode features one woman sharing her personal story with you. Too often, we fall into the traps of comparison and judgment, but what if we took the time to hear each other's real stories? Let's remember that we all have a story, and our stories matter. We're so glad you've joined us on this podcast journey. May you find hope and encouragement in this episode's story. Hi, ladies, and thank you for tuning into this episode of the Story Night podcast. If this is your first time finding us, welcome. We're so glad you're here. We highly recommend checking out episode 46, as that will give you the most up-to-date information about our 501c3 nonprofit. It will introduce you to our board of directors and tell you all about Story Night's history and vision and purpose. For those of you who have been here for a while, you know that this is a place where women in our local community can come together and tell their stories. And some of them are really, really heavy. Some of them are really lighthearted. And the ladies who share come from all different backgrounds, every different worldview, age, life stage, you name it. It's just a place for any woman to tell her story with the purpose of building community and encouraging others and reminding you that no matter what you're going through, you are not alone. I'm so excited for you to meet my new friend, Robin, and she has a story that, of course, has many chapters to it, but one of the chapters that we're going to focus on for this episode is a story of adoption. And I know many of you out there have adoption stories. Maybe you were adopted. Maybe you have adopted. Maybe somebody in your family was adopted or went through the adoption process. And there are so many different types of adoption. And we wanted to take a handful of episodes with the Story Night podcast to really focus on some adoption stories because August 25th is Oregon Adoption Day. And probably not a lot of people even know that because it's relatively new. In the 2025 long session, Representative Lucetta Elmer, who is a former Story Night speaker, put forth a bill to create Oregon Adoption Day. And it was this incredible moment when all of these legislators from both sides of the aisle came together and told their adoption stories. And it became this bipartisan bill that everyone was supporting and it got signed into law. So from now on, August 25th is Oregon Adoption Day. And it's just a chance to celebrate all kinds of adoption, elevate the conversation. And like with many other types of stories, as soon as you say that you have a story related to adoption, suddenly you meet all these other people that have adoption stories also, and you are amazed at the amount of connectivity that there is when you start opening up and telling about your stories. So I'm thrilled that we get to have Robin tell us her story. So thank you, Robin, so much for being willing to do this. And at the time of this recording, this is your first day off, your first day of summer. So thank you for being willing to come to the studio and tell your story. It is such a beautiful story. And thank you, Candace, for recommending Robin. We really appreciate that. So let's start with just an introduction. Will you tell everybody a little bit of who you are, your life, work, family today? Then we'll rewind the tape and we'll hear your story.
Great. Well, thank you for having me. My name's Robin Van Buren. I live here in McMinnville, raised in McMinnville. Currently, I serve as the Director of Teaching and Learning and High School Principal for the Dayton School District. I just completed my third year in that district. Like you said, today is my first official day of summer break. And I have two sons, Oliver and Wyatt. Oliver just turned 12. Wyatt will be 24 this month. And then I've been married to my husband, Mike, for, 17 years. And we've been together a long time prior to that as well. So Thanks again for having me.
Well, thank you so much for all that you do in the field of education. As one educator to another, I know none of it is easy. It is a critically important job. And just from the little bit that I've heard from you and your stories, I know you've made an incredible impact in our community. And there are so many stories that you have intersected and touched. And I hope someday we get to have, some of your former students on here telling their stories and how you've changed their lives. But there's one student in particular whose life you especially changed. So cliffhanger there. listeners. We'll leave you with that for a moment. But let's, you said you were raised in McMinnville. So we're going to speed through the first 25, 27, 29 years of your life and then park at a really special story. But will you take us quickly through your childhood, how you met your husband and started your family, your career, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So my parents are from Southern California. That's where all my extended family live, but they moved to Oregon to have kids. So I was originally born in Portland and we lived in Hillsborough till I was five. And then we moved to McMinnville and I went to Adams Elementary all through elementary school. And then I went to Patton Middle School and then back to Mack High, which oddly enough, my ninth grade year, they opened the ninth grade campus back at Adams Elementary. So I entered high school back in my elementary school, which wasn't that cool. I graduated from Mac in 2003 and ended up going to the University of Oregon. Go Ducks. Lived with my best friend from high school my first year there and ended up getting a bachelor's in broadcast journalism. I was an intern on a radio show and thought I would be famous on ESPN one day. Then realized that would be a long haul and journalists really don't make enough money to survive at that early in their career. So I went back to school at George Fox and got my Master of Art in Teaching. Because my whole life I had worked with kids. I worked at summer camps, I tutored, I worked at the juvenile detention center. So really my path was education. My mom always told me that's where I would land. I just wanted to be stubborn and go my own route for a while. And then after I graduated, I got a job teaching in Sheridan at Faulkner Chapman School. But my first year of teaching, after that first year, I got laid off because it was like 2009, 2010, and there was a lot of budget cuts. So I ended up working 1 year at Head Start and then landed back at Faulkner Chapman. I met my husband when I was a senior in high school. So the tail end of my senior year, we met through some mutual friends because he's from Newburgh. He's a little bit older than me. Much to my mom's chagrin, he ended up moving to Eugene and followed me down there when I was at U of O. And he kind of worked his way up in retail and now works for Builders First Source. I don't even know his new job. He just got another promotion. but we got engaged my senior year of college, I want to say, and then ended up getting married after I finished my master's program, so got married at what was formerly the Bayou Golf Course here in McMinnville. Yeah, so we've been together a really long time. We've worked really hard to build a pretty good life with each other. So I'm really proud of everything we've done. And then, yeah, so I guess going back to my working history, I was back at Faulkner Chapman. I was hired back as a sixth grade teacher and I started teaching like a humanities, so English and social studies amongst other things over the years.
If you pause right here, everything sounds amazing, right? Like you've done the things, you've met the guy, everything's feeling settled, this great trajectory. And as many women can relate with, you get your career going. You find a husband, you get settled down. And if they, for women who want to build a family, the next thing is let's have kids. Yep. and go from there. And your story kind of took maybe two surprising turns, right?
Yep. Yeah. We definitely knew we wanted to have kids once I was kind of settled into my teaching career. And that was actually a fairly long journey for us. It took over 2 years to be able to get pregnant. With my younger son, Oliver. We had a miscarriage in there. I tried some acupuncture that I heard worked and then magically I was pregnant. So if you haven't tried acupuncture, try it. And so we ended up having one biological child. And once we kind of settled into that routine, we really thought that we were good with just having one kid. We really loved being able to travel and take Oliver to the duck games and just be able to pick up and go a little easier. And he was a super easy baby, a really pretty easy toddler. And I hated being pregnant. So I was like, we're good. We'll just have one kid. And that's yeah. kind of where we thought our story as parents would end.
So you thought.
Yes.
And I say this now on almost every episode, the one universal of every woman's story is it doesn't turn out the way we expect.
Yeah.
So at this point, you're late 20s
mm-hmm.
and you've got your miracle baby. who's relatively easy, which is great. And things are where you would want them to be. You're teaching, you're making a difference. You've got your child, you're able to travel. You and your husband are working and settled and all is well. Yep. And you could end the story right there and say, and they lived happily ever after. But then surprises come in your life. So this is all going to start within your teaching career. Mm-hmm. And maybe, do you think you could take just, I don't know, 30 seconds and sort of paint the picture of where you were teaching, maybe the dynamics? Because, you know, you say teaching and different schools have different personalities, right? Yeah. Different dynamics. You can be teaching at a really rural school. You can be teaching at a high-end private school. And they all kind of have different demographics. And the students have different needs and kind of what that looks like. So where were you teaching when a particular student really entered your life?
Yep. So when I was teaching in Sheridan, like I said, at Faulkner Chapman School, the demographics of Sheridan is high poverty, a lot of students coming to us experiencing trauma, neglect, abuse. I don't know if this statistic stands true, but when I was there, it used to be Sheridan would get the bulk of like calls to DHS in Yamhill County, even though it makes up a pretty small portion of Yamhill County. So we were learning about trauma-informed practices and teaching with poverty in mind before it became kind of more widespread in education. And it definitely threw me for a loop my first year there, because I went in as a teacher thinking that students all came from a family like mine, which I didn't come from a lot of money, but I had a stable home life, and my parents placed a high value on education for me. And so it was definitely a little earth shattering when I realized, oh, okay, we have kids coming with different needs and different stories. And I really had to adjust my philosophies and my approach to really meet each kid where they were at individually. Mm-hmm. That's really the only way I found that teachers who lasted in Sheridan would be successful.
Right. Well, and especially if it wasn't your own personal experience. Mm-hmm. And to try and earn their trust.
Yep.
Because it's not like you could come to them saying, hey, I've totally lived this life. I've experienced all of your experiences. So they presumably are looking at you going, what do you know about my world? What do you know about my life? So that takes a while to earn any kind of trust.
Yes. And I would tell a lot of my new teachers out in Sheridan, and still to this day when I mentor teachers, a lot of those students had people that abandoned them over and over. So they were just kind of waiting for you to leave. And I think once they saw that I wasn't going anywhere and that I would go to bat for them, even when they made a decision they probably shouldn't have made, then that trust started to build. And that, I think, is the key to classroom management, even in today's education, is building trust with your students.
Yeah. And it was at 2012 when you met Wyatt?
Yes, I was thinking about that timeline last night. So I met Wyatt actually when he was a fifth grader, because Faulkner Chapman is a K-8 school. And I was teaching sixth grade at the time, but I was teaching his older brother. So I had his older brother in my class. And then I would just hear these stories of what Wyatt and his older brother were doing, you know, outside of school. And I'd see Wyatt one time, I was walking into the building. He's like up in a tree. I'm like, what are you doing up there, buddy? And he had this long, shaggy hair, and he was just kind of this squirrely little guy. So I didn't know him super well as a fifth grader, but when he came into my class the following year as a sixth grader, I kind of knew like he was going to be a kid I need to connect with right away in order to get him to want to work in my class and to believe in himself. And right at the beginning of that school year is when I found out I was pregnant. And almost instantly, I had really bad morning sickness that was really just all day sickness. So it was a rocky start for me personally as a teacher, just because I felt so terrible and I'm trying to be on my A game. But I had this group of sixth graders come in. And at that point, I still taught all sixth graders. So somewhere in the day, if you were a sixth grader, you had me. And Wyatt definitely stood out right away as one of the kids that I knew was going to need a different approach. I remember I would not even raise my voice because I'm not a yeller, but I would just say, hey, what are you doing? And he would just go leave, like run out the door, run out the building. And I was like, oh, where did he go? And so it was a lot of that, a lot of calls home, no calls back. You know, I'd invite family to conferences because I had a lot of concerns about Wyatt and his behavior getting in the way of him being educated. But slowly, we just started to build trust. And I can't even remember specifically what the tipping point was, but somewhere probably closer to winter break, I think a light just switched with him and he just started to see me as like kind of a school mom, I would say. And so he started staying in my class and, you know, attempting the work and engaging a little bit in the conversations. And I just started taking him more and more under my wing because I saw that potential in him and I saw the like curiosity he started to have about, well, maybe I could do this. Maybe I can be a quote unquote good kid, a quote unquote good student. So we had a really fun year that year. That group of kids, you'll find out later in my story, just became very close to me for lots of reasons. But I ended up leaving at the end of April because I had Oliver on April 29th. So I was off on maternity leave and I had put in a ton of work to prep my sub and had her in multiple times and made all these binders of here's all the work you could do. And I remember going back in a couple weeks after having Oliver to bring him in and show him to my students and just check in how they were doing and why it was not doing well. And then ultimately, he just called it an early summer break and quit coming to school for the rest of his sixth grade year because he said if I wasn't there, he wasn't going to come. And he didn't. So that summer, I was off all summer long with Oliver on my maternity leave. And then in the fall, I went back to teach and I learned that I'd be teaching seventh grade. So I looped with all of those sixth graders. I became most of their teachers in seventh grade, which was amazing because it was so easy to just hit the ground running. So I made sure I had Wyatt in my class. He came back to school because I was back. And then I want to say it was somewhere earlier in his seventh grade year, I got a call from my principal, who's also a longtime family friend. And she said Wyatt had been taken from his home and placed in a home in Dallas, I believe. Oh, I haven't thought about this in so long. Okay. And that was really hard for me because I knew that would be catastrophic for him. But luckily, he wasn't there long, like a matter of days. And a family in Sheridan stepped up and offered to take him in and take his brother in. And at some point, I believe they had all of his siblings living with them. But they ultimately decided to be his foster family. So Wyatt came back to school and we got him all settled. And I knew he was bored because he told me while he was there, he was so bored and I think scared that he was reading Twilight. Like he... That was not why. So I was like, wow, you were really bored if you were reading Twilight. So seventh grade, he really started to blossom. And that's kind of when the joke became, why it's your favorite student? Why it's your favorite student? And kids would always lovingly give me a hard time, like, you let Wyatt get away with more than any of us can. And there was one other student, Michaela, they're like, those two are your favorite. But they knew I loved all of them. And so he was with that family through seventh grade. And then eighth grade, I had him again. I would just request every year,
you just keep moving up.
Yeah.
Like, this is your cohort.
Yes. So again, I had most of those kids for eighth grade. And I would always ask that Wyatt be put in as many of my classes as possible. At that point, I was teaching AVID and like a newspaper class because in a small district, you teach everything. And so I just put him in my class, make him my aide. I don't care. I just want to keep him out of trouble. And that year was really special because there's a big tradition at Faulkner Chapman, eighth grade promotions, like a huge deal. And the kids vote their speaker. And I got voted to be their teacher speaker. So I kind of got to wrap up that year with them in a special way. And that was my final year of teaching because I became a half-time grant manager the following year and then a half-time assistant principal. So it was nice to kind of wrap things up with that group. So then Wyatt went off to high school, which is just down the road in Sheridan, and I was still teaching or working in Sheridan. So I would just check in on him periodically. I knew his foster family pretty well, so I would check in with them because they would volunteer, just see how's Wyatt doing. I'd go down like on my birthday, I'd bring lunch and go have lunch with Wyatt. But then that year is when things started to not be going as well for him personally and for his foster family. And he started making some questionable decisions. His grades really started tanking. And then one day I get a call from DHS saying, we have Wyatt here. And he said that one time you told him if anything happened, you'd take him in, which... backtracking, yes, I did say that. I did tell Wyatt once that if anything happened, he'd come live with me. Never thinking that would actually occur.
But he remembered.
Yeah. So I talked to my husband. At this point, Oliver was almost three. And I said, hey, you know, Wyatt doesn't have anywhere to go. He ran away from home and he needs a place to stay. And Mike didn't know Wyatt well, but he knew a lot about him because I always talked about him at home. And at that point, we had some friends that were older than us that were empty nesters that were thinking about getting into foster, and they lived just around the corner from us. So initially, I was like, well, he could come stay with us, and then if they get certified to foster, and maybe that could be kind of a more long-term placement, but then I'm just right around the corner. Mm-hmm. And Mike said, yeah, we can do that. That's kind of what he initially agreed to. And just a little backstory on my husband. He didn't have the easiest childhood. He lost his dad at 12 in a pretty traumatic way. And so I think he internally was like, this is my chance to give back, because there was a handful of teachers in particular that never gave up on him and are the reason a lot of ways why he is where he is today. So Wyatt showed up in that stereotypical way. He literally had a black trash bag with all his belongings. And we luckily had moved into our second home at that point. So we had a spare bedroom that had been a guest bedroom. So I just made it all up for him. I remember one thing early on, like going to Walmart and buying him underwear. And here's my student who still calls me Miss V to this day, saying, Miss V, I don't know. And people are looking at it. It's kind of weird. Like, why is this lady buying underwear for her student? And it's just that awkward, you know, he didn't know Mike. And my husband's a big guy, so he can be a little intimidating, I think. And then obviously he knew Oliver because I brought Oliver to like all the dances I would chaperone and stuff. But you're in this new space trying to have your routine with this family's routine. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely awkward at first, I think more for him than us. And I just remember like he needed a bike so he could go out and bike. So we ended up giving him a bike that July for his birthday, you know, just trying to fast forward to this teenager that we now have living with us. And then when he first came to live with us, it wasn't the greatest timing because we were planning a trip to California to go see my family and celebrate Oliver's third birthday and go to Disneyland. And it was way too last minute to try to include Wyatt just logistically. So then luckily we had a friend that I worked with in Sheridan who has a son a year younger than Wyatt, I believe. So Wyatt was able to stay there, but I just remember feeling so bad, like he's just transitioned here, now he's going to transition there and then have to come back when we get back. But we got through that kind of awkward phase, and pretty early on, I would say within a month or less even, I just remember telling Mike, like, Wyatt can't go anywhere. He's just meant to be with us. And he was so good with Oliver, and I have pictures of them. Like one popped up the other day, laying on the couch, and Oliver's just laying on top of him because it was like this instant big brother, and Oliver just was in awe. And I think he was so young that really he won't really remember a time without Wyatt being his big brother. And so Mike agreed with me, and he still is like, I don't know how I became a dad to an instant teenager. So Wyatt's birthday is July 10th, which is funny because Mike's birthday is July 9th. So we celebrated him turning 15 that first summer. And then we started going down the path of adoption and worked with his caseworker. And because I had known him so long, I was considered next of kin. So that actually helped speed the process up. But we had to do like the parenting classes in Portland, which were kind of just boring because being an educator, I was like, I've done these trainings before. But yeah, we just kept living life. The next year, I was still in Sheridan. So we kept Wyatt at Sheridan High School. So he started his sophomore year. I remember we did all the school clothes shopping. I helped him make a sign to ask this girl to homecoming and got all the cheesy pictures and, you know, just normal teenage stuff. And then the following year, we knew we were going to be able to adopt him, but we wanted to wait until he turned 16 officially, just because that would open up more scholarship opportunities for him for college. So we officially adopted him on August 9th of 2018. But yeah, in between there, I taught him to drive, which is terrifying. Bought him a car. We went to Hawaii for his 16th birthday. And then he was officially a part of our family.
Amazing. And I mean, there's so much to unpack in that part, but where is he now?
So Wyatt graduated in 2020, which was lame because it was COVID, but Sheridan did a nice job of giving every kid like an individual ceremony. And at that point I was working at McMinnville High School, so I wasn't in the school district anymore. So we still got to celebrate him. And then he ended up getting straight A's from the time he moved in with us. Because silly me, I offered him $20 an A because I knew he was motivated by money. And all of a sudden, he got all those A's. And that actually was such a blessing in disguise because he got the GPA that he needed to get Chemeketa Scholars. So he got a full ride to Chemeketa. He lived with us during that time. This was still crazy COVID times, and went to Chemeketa, got his associates, and then transferred to Western Oregon University and got his bachelor's in criminology. So he'll be 24. And right now he lives in Willamina with his girlfriend, Ann Marissa. They've been together since like 10th grade. So they've been together a really long time. She's a part of our family. We take her on trips. She spends all the holidays with us, and they split, you know, between her family and ours. And so right now he's just, you know, in that process of trying to figure out what's next and what's kind of that job I want to get to start a career, not just job that you work to make enough money to get by. And she works for the tribe. So yeah, they're doing really good.
You know, and you pause the story right there, and it sounds like a Disney movie or a Hallmark movie, like this beautiful adoption story that, you know, at face value, everything's smooth and amazing. And he was meant to be your son, and just all of the beautiful elements of it. And anyone who knows anything about adoption knows it's still hard.
Yeah.
Like some stories are smoother than others, certainly, but there are challenges in there. Sometimes things that you don't even think of. You know, for anybody who's maybe curious about adoption or thinking about it, I wanted to give you a chance to touch on both. Maybe some of the challenges you didn't see, but then also the blessings and the gifts and the beauty that maybe people don't take time to recognize.
Yeah. I think when I tell my story, and especially when I tell it to people interested in an adoption through the foster system, I try to also be realistic. Wyatt is such a unique story in the sense that I knew him really, really well and had a really well-established relationship with him, that I more or less knew what I was signing up for. I think for other people, for Wyatt's younger brother, for example, he was adopted about the same time out of the foster system by a family in Portland. And at first that was going well, but didn't end well. And ultimately they said, we don't know if you can, we can be your parents anymore. And I think the trauma that they had all experienced, Wyatt and all of his siblings for many years, played out differently for his siblings. And for whatever reason, Wyatt was able to navigate that and always find what he needed and who he needed to advocate for him and to keep moving forward. But I know he personally carries guilt, like he let his siblings down, but I've reminded him over and over, you were a kid. That was not your job to raise your siblings and keep them safe. That was adults' jobs, and they didn't do their job. So I think that's my caution, but also the reason to do it. Like, we have all these kids who need a stable home and need an adult who can believe in them just all the time, not just in school. And the more we can do that for kids, I think we would see a shift in society, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. But I think that's, I just want people to go into that situation knowing that it's not always going to be a Disney movie. And even along the way, we had our normal, like, Wyatt would get grounded for things that he would do, normal teenage stuff. But honestly, he was very well behaved and a pretty easy teenager to raise. I'm more worried about raising Oliver as a teenager.
Well, I think it's so important to shed light on really all of it, because every story is so unique. Every child is so unique. But you brought up something that's so key, is like just that ability to change society as a whole. When often, pick any topic, we look at our world or our community or our state and think the problems are too big. Mm-hmm. They're too overwhelming. What can one person do? It feels like it's too far gone. Again, whatever your worldview is, wherever you land on, you know, any of the subjects out there that are talked about, it seems like one person can't make that big of a difference. And even though we hear all these stories, and so many of the stories that are on this podcast are of women who had childhoods like Wyatt, mm-hmm. they were the kids that were neglected or abused or forgotten or fill in the blank. And in all of their stories, there is someone who becomes their champion. Someone who doesn't give up on them. And it doesn't always mean that they completely took them in and adopted them and made a lifelong commitment of that magnitude. Sometimes it was just them spending a few minutes with them here and there, or just sending them messages, reminding them that you are loved, you matter, I believe in you, you have potential, you can do this. And all those little seeds eventually get watered and they grow. And these women are now able to tell their stories from a really good place in their life, which is amazing. I mean, this is a show just for women, but part of me wants to have Wyatt on the show to tell his story, because it's incredible. What you did is a really, really big deal. And if so many people were able to do even a piece of that, what could we see happen to our youth and the mental health crisis, like troubles within education, fill in the blank.
Yeah, I think what you said at the start there about feeling so overwhelmed at just the sheer magnitude, I think in education, we can all agree we feel that way. But if you just take time to reflect, especially at now that I'm, you know, many years into the field, and think kid by kid that either I help make a difference for or other staff members, like that makes a huge impact over time. And I think just looking at funding and some of the crisis that's going on in our state in particular with schools, until we prioritize doing what's right in schools, we're going to continue to see people coming out not ready to be in society because there's just different needs that students are facing right now. And the more adults we can surround them with doing what you said, even just a small part, even if it's just volunteering in a school and being a mentor. I mean, I can't think of all the times I've tried to problem solve around a student who's really struggling, some of my male students in particular, and they just need a strong male mentor. And that doesn't exist in this community. There's no big brother, big sister programs. So it's just really hard, especially in rural schools, to get those resources for kids. Yeah. And so that would be another piece of advice I'd just like to put out there is like, you don't need to be a teacher. You don't need to adopt a child, but you can make such a huge impact in various ways that will totally change the trajectory of kids' lives.
That's amazing. And of course, now my brain is spinning like, well, how do we get these programs in our community? Let's get this started. Anyone listening who wants to spearhead like a committee and let's do this, let's make a difference. But, you know, in closing, at the end of every episode, I ask our speakers, you know, what words of encouragement would you give to those listening? And I feel like you have done that. But are there any other words or thoughts that you wanted to share that you haven't already?
I have a quote at the end of my email that I don't remember word for word, but basically boils down to every child deserves a champion in their lives. And I think that the more adults that can be a champion for a kid, whether that's adopting out of foster care or volunteering or becoming an educator or working with CASA, whatever it might be, I just think the more champions we have, the more lives we will impact and give kids a chance to really become adults who thrive and give back to our local community and society as a whole.
Well, Robin, you most certainly are a champion, and it has been such an honor to get to hear your story. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to go back through it and to share it with all of us. Your family and your students and your staff are all just so blessed by you, and I'm certain that you are going to be a huge inspiration to our listeners. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, Oregon Adoption Day is coming up on August 25th, and I wanted to share a little announcement about that with everybody. For anyone listening who is an Oregon resident with a personal connection to adoption in some way, there is a very special opportunity. To honor Adoption Day this year, Lucetta is hosting a statewide contest to design the official Oregon Adoption Day logo. If you'd like more details or an entry form, you can email storynighthope@gmail.com, and we'll put those emails in the episode notes. Also in the episode notes will be the link to register for our next Story Night event. Now, for those of you who are new, in addition to this podcast, we host 4 events each year. And these are events that are just super fun girls' night outs, and they are free. They include snacks and wine and prizes and lots of connectivity and, of course, an incredible story. Our next event is October 1st at the Chehalem Cultural Center, featuring Amy Widmer. Part of her story includes a breast cancer journey, and as I'm sure all of you know, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. This particular October, Story Night is partnering with a local organization for breast cancer warriors called With Courage. With Courage was founded by Caitlin Sticka, and you can hear her story on episode 23. And you'll just have to join us on October 1st to hear all about this very special October partnership. Seating is limited, so you'll want to jump online and get those free tickets as soon as possible. And yes, you heard that right, tickets are free. And we are often asked how in the world these events can be free. Well, that would not be possible without the incredible support of amazing local businesses and their sponsorships. You can check out all of the amazing business sponsors on our website, and I always like to highlight our 2026 headline sponsoring business, Gray's Craze. Gray's Craze is an international franchise of charcuterie boards and boxes, and we are so blessed here in McMinnville, Oregon, to have a local one owned by Jennifer Richter. You can hear her story on episode 28, and Jennifer is also a cancer survivor. And we are so excited to share that Gray's Craze will also be providing all of the food for our October 1st event. So just another reason why you don't want to miss out. So thank you, Grace Craze, and all of the businesses and individuals who have donated to Story Night in some way. Your support is what makes these events and this podcast possible so that we can keep bringing more stories of encouragement and hope to more women. And of course, this wouldn't work at all if we didn't have women who were willing to share their stories. So Robin, thank you again so much for opening up your story to us. It is so beautiful. And thank you, ladies, for tuning in to this episode. We hope that you were blessed, inspired, encouraged, and that you come back next time for our next story. Until then, remember, you have a story, your story matters, and you are not alone.